And we're talking philosophy for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with Peter Cave, who is himself a philosopher and writer and speaker. And he is someone who has written extensively on the history of philosophy and the nature of philosophy, and written extensively on the topic with books like Beginner's Guides to Humanism, to Philosophy, to Ethics, as well as This Sentence is False, An Introduction to Philosophical Paradoxes. And his most recent book is called How to Think Like a Philosopher, Scholars, Dreamers, and Sages Who Can Teach Us How to Live. And in this book, Peter Cave surveys the work and legacy of a number of different philosophers down through history, 30 of them in all. And many of them will be familiar names. Some likely will be unfamiliar. And one comes away from reading this book with a new sense of what the work of philosophers is, and the debt that we all owe to philosophers in helping us understand better ourselves and the human condition. The book is published by Bloomsbury. And Peter Cave, we welcome you to the morning show.
Many thanks for inviting me. I should like quickly to add, I am but a humble philosopher, and I tend to think philosophers should all of them be humble and recognize we muddle through on lots of these issues.
Very good. Tell us first, if you would, what drew you in the first place to the field of philosophy? I mean, for instance, as a young person, were you taken by the work of philosophers, interested in it and exploring it actively, or is this an interest that came to you a little later in life?
I notice your assumption that I was a young person. You clearly have an idea of personal identity, which many philosophers worry about, as do I. But taking your question with a little bit of seriosity, when I was a teenager, I was of a generation in Great Britain when the BBC radio had a third programme in which they would have talks by Bertrand Russell, a great philosopher, plays by Jean-Paul Sartre, another great philosopher. And my entrance, therefore, into philosophy was as a teenager, being very concerned about these basic issues about the nature of reality, the nature of morality, and so forth. Much later on, when students have asked me, Peter, why ever did you do philosophy? I now think the correct answer was probably, you don't really need to know anything. You just need to know how to argue. And as my mind starts detaching itself from its memory, I find it's much easier to argue about things, to question Greg about his idea of personal identity, which he assumed a little earlier on, than actually trying to remember lots of facts. I think that's why I never became a lawyer. Hence, a philosopher really is engaged in reasoning and thinking and arguing.
You've already, in a sense, anticipated my next question, which was to help those of us who are not philosophers to better understand what the field is really about. I think we've already danced around it a bit, but how would you state the sort of essential purpose of philosophy and the work of philosophers?
I suppose I'd like to jump in about the word purpose there. Well, what's the point of philosophy? What's the purpose of philosophy? One point or purpose of philosophy is to point out that you don't actually have to have points in order to be doing something valuable. I think it's a great mistake, maybe a mistake of societies in general, that everything has to have a point or purpose. Instead of reminding yourself, things can be valuable in themselves. And so I'd like to think that my book tries to bring this out, but also it does try to bring out how some things which you may think are valuable in themselves are not necessarily so. I steal an example and corrupt it a little bit from Plato, but many people tend to think the only thing which is valuable in life is pleasure. And so Plato, in my version of him, would point out, if that really is the case, then why don't you buy some itching powder and a back scratcher and sprinkle the itching powder over your back and scratch? You'll have an itch, and then you'll have the pleasure of scratching, itch, scratching, itch, scratching. Wouldn't that be a great life? It would be a life filled with pleasures. And yet I suspect not even the most hedonistic individual around here would actually see that as a valuable life. That links to a great philosopher in the 19th century, John Stuart Mill, who maybe is now thought of as a Victorian and fuddy-duddy in Britain, but in fact he was very wise and very thoughtful about the importance of liberty, and one of his famous quotes is, "It's better to be a dissatisfied Socrates than a satisfied pig." I would have something to say in favor of the pig at times. I often succumb to wine and excess cheese. But Mill is right in the sense that you don't just want a life as a piggish life. You recognize that human beings, in fact, do have more potential, more valuable items which could actually bring more importance to their lives.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Peter Cave about his book, How to Think Like a Philosopher, Scholars, Dreamers, and Sages Who Can Teach Us How to Live. You make an interesting distinction in the prologue of your book by saying that that philosophy was at one point divided into natural philosophy and moral philosophy. Can you explain what that distinction was and is?
Well, indeed I can. Well, I can try. Remember, I said I was a humble philosopher, so everything's involved in trying and often failing. Samuel Beckett spoke in terms of, no matter, try again, fail again. How true, I think, with most of our lives. But yes, the distinction is just what today we put in terms of science, in which there's empirical investigations going on. You go on archaeological sites, you invest in various colliders, you maybe risk your life in a laboratory by exploding some chemicals, whereas a philosopher these days does not engage in those activities at all. He'll be reasoning, thinking about the nature of science rather than being engaged in scientific experiments. On the moral philosophy side, or the moral sciences, that's where, of course, he's thinking about how one ought to live, what constitutes the virtues, what's right and wrong, the nature of happiness, in Aristotelian terms, the nature of having a flourishing life. And that could bring us back to John Stuart Mill, in which you would think a flourishing life should not be conceived of solely in terms of, the piggish pleasures. So yes, moral philosophy, moral sciences is an old-fashioned term for philosophy, which we now think of in general, which also now covers more extensively the philosophy of mathematics, the philosophy of science. I'd like to jump in, though, that there's a problem here which I've avoided mentioning, but I'd like to mention, namely philosophy does have that impression being highly academic, highly abstruse, highly abstract. And indeed, if you are studying some elements of philosophy at universities or colleges, it may well come over that way. One reason why I wrote this book, apart from being invited to be on your show, Greg, was in fact to bring out that philosophy can be exhilarating, it can be fun, it can be exciting. And so, as you may know, if you really have looked at my book, I do make the odd joke, I draw attention to some odd things, some odd rumours about Monsieur Descartes, the French philosopher, how allegedly he built a robot, gave the robot the name of his illegitimate daughter Francine, and went round with her everywhere through France. That probably wasn't true, but it was a rumor about him.
I agree that it is actually a very lively book, and probably livelier and more entertaining than some people might guess it could possibly be. I enjoyed it start to finish. I also wanted to mention on a personal level that it was as a junior in college that I took my first and what turned out to be my only course in philosophy. At the time, I was a music major and religion major, double major. But I took Introduction to Philosophy, and it is still, I look back on it as my favorite course in my 4 years of college. And if it had not come across my path so late, I would have switched one of my majors to philosophy. I mean, that's how much I enjoyed the endeavor. And still regret that I didn't explore this further. And it occurs to me that maybe one problem is, for a lot of people, they don't encounter philosophy early enough, that it is something that, I mean, at least very little that's called philosophy is taught, for instance, in elementary school or junior high or high school. Do you think that's a mistake that we are making?
I do believe that, and indeed, as you probably know, in countries such as France and Germany, they do engage with philosophical questions far more at school than ever happens in Great Britain, and I assume in the States. I think it's also important, though, to bring out that when we were talking about how philosophy may seem so abstract and difficult, because one area of philosophy is called metaphysics, where you really are looking into the nature of time or the nature of reality, rather than into the ethics, looking into the nature of morality and virtues, there's a very useful thought I make deploy from G.E. Moore. G.E. Moore is a little-known Cambridge philosopher of the early 20th century. In fact, he's very influential on the Bloomsbury Group, on people such as Virginia Woolf and so forth. But Moore, when he was a young student of the moral sciences, as it was then called at Cambridge, he met an older person, MacTaggart, James MacTaggart, Ellis MacTaggart, very much committed to metaphysics. And MacTaggart would say things like, time is unreal. And G.E. Moore would sort of puncture that by saying, Jack, he was known as Jack, Jack, do you really mean to tell me that I didn't have my breakfast before I had my lunch and before I had my tea? So I think one valuable element of, I like to think, my book and of G.E. Moore is to remind ourselves that when philosophers make some of these very strange statements, it's worth asking them, well, what do you actually mean in common sense terms? Time is unreal? Well, hold on, surely you don't mean I didn't have my breakfast before I had my dinner. We could make similar questions directed at scientists, of course, when they claim time might be unreal. So that's one example in which I think my book might be useful to some people. It can encourage people to wonder a bit quite what is meant and be prepared to even the greatest philosophers say, well, I wonder what you mean by that, put it in normal English. Another related point there is interpretation. And so a so-called existentialist philosopher of the 19th century called Søren Kierkegaard from Denmark, there's a little tale he tells about himself in which he's walking along and he sees a new shop has opened which says, bring your washing here. And so he scurries off to his apartments to collect together his dirty washing and to go to the shop to give his washing to the laundry. And then he realizes when he gets there, it wasn't a laundry at all. It was, in fact, a shop selling signs, such as bring your washing here. So Kierkegaard is very keen on realizing that we have to look at our interpretations far more carefully than we normally do.
Very good. In the prologue, you prepare us for what follows, that is, this introduction to 30 different philosophers and their work, by saying that you are providing for the reader a snapshot, sometimes a medley of shots. Explain why you are framing your book in that respect, that these are snapshots. What are you suggesting there, and why do you think it's valuable for the reader to think of that with your book before reading it?
I want to entice. I want people to think this book is worth buying, possibly even reading, but primarily to buy it, of course. But no, why I see it in terms of snapshots is my publisher wanted me to write about 30 distinct thinkers. The book couldn't be so long, and so it would be bizarre to think I could present the whole work of an individual philosopher. And it would be very, very tedious if I just looked at one specific argument in detail. That would hardly be appropriate to an introductory book. So the idea of a snapshot is indeed to stimulate readers to think, well, I find that bit boring, but this bit is fascinating, so I will pursue that point about Friedrich Nietzsche, for example. I really will get involved in reading about Simone de Beauvoir and so forth. Maybe I should add here, as you've implied, that although he has some of the great philosophers, which we all think of as a great philosophers, such as Plato and Aristotle and Immanuel Kant and Monsieur Descartes, it also has some thinkers deliberately so, whom people in the outside world, so to speak, would not normally think of as major philosophers or important philosophers. So it includes Iris Murdoch. Most people know her as a novelist, but in fact she was something of a philosopher initially, and she was very important. She has become important in philosophy. I deliberately involved Lewis Carroll, who wrote the Alice in Wonderland books. He did write some philosophical articles, but obviously he's mainly known for his children's stories. But if you start reading Alice in Wonderland, then I think you can quickly see there's lots of philosophical thoughts going on there. In fact, I'd always recommend that book to my students, Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, to start approaching some deep problems in the philosophy of language. These are great books. I strongly recommend them. After you've bought my book, of course, I hasten to say. So Lewis Carroll is important. Simone Weil, I mentioned Sappho at the beginning as the poetess in ancient Greece, as that might attract some people into thinking, yes, it doesn't actually have to be a formal philosopher to raise some philosophical thoughts.
Absolutely.
That's the idea. Hmm. And I have some bleakness in my life in the end when I think about these things, so I couldn't resist. I just had to include Samuel Beckett, who does remind us of our rather biological conditions in this world, which you may see some spiritual aspect to this, but rather like Beckett, and like Schopenhauer, and probably like you, Greg, I think that one can find oneself, in my case, lose oneself in music. So I strongly recommend, as Schopenhauer does, that maybe to cope with life, it's better to lose yourself into some wonderful pieces of music. Hmm. Whether the music be the Pet Shop Boys or be Schubert, well, I go for Schubert these days, but I'm open to discussion on that.
A last overarching question, and then we'll probe into a few specifics. It is 30 philosophers in all, and the vast majority of them are men. There are some women there. And I just wonder, when we look at these collectively, the fact that most of them are men, do you think that in any way sort of colors the content of what is offered?
Surely you're not implying that a male philosopher cannot take a completely objective view on the universe. But maybe you are implying, maybe some women would imply that. But yes, I did deliberately include more women in the book than you would normally find. Hence we have Sappho, we have Simone Weil, we have Simone de Beauvoir. But you're right, the great philosophers, because at that time it was a man's world, so to speak, tended to be men. But there were some philosophers who wrote at that time who were women, but those obviously are not so well known. I'm not totally convinced that there's a very clear divide between men and women in their philosophical thinking, but there may be a tendency to think of women as involving more the emotions to one's biological life than the reasoning. But David Hume, the 18th century philosopher, would point out that too. Although Hume is often thought of as a great Enlightenment figure, and he was, stressing the importance of reason, he also did stress the importance of the sentiments, of the feelings for each other, of fellow feeling to ground morality. So it's not a clear black or white issue, I think.
I agree.
Well, I know. I wouldn't dare to say I know. Being a humble philosopher, go back to the original point.
Right.
I was manifesting some consistency there.
We're speaking with Peter Cave about his book, How to Think Like a Philosopher, Scholars, Dreamers, and Sages, Who Can Teach Us How to Live. One of the names, I'll be honest, that I did not know before reading your book was the earliest of the philosophers whose work you explore in the very first chapter. And he is someone who you say whose very existence, activities, and writings are covered by the shrouds of mystery. Tell us more about the shrouds of mystery that surround this earliest philosopher in your book, one Lao Tzu, and why, despite the mystery that shrouds him, why he is worthy of inclusion here.
That Lao Tzu, as you've picked up, does seem to be somebody in which there's great doubts whether he did even exist. But he's associated with the religious approach of Taoism. And Taoism would often occur in comparative religious courses, but I thought it would be of interest to make the point, as I said earlier, to show how even analytical philosophers can take into account, in this case, somebody who would normally be thought of as more of a religious theologian philosopher. And why he's fascinating, though, is because he starts drawing attention to those things which cannot be said. And it's very enigmatic. It's quite fascinating because he speaks of there's a way which cannot be spoken of, and yet there he is, he's speaking of the way. Paradoxically, though, a much later philosopher, just a few decades ago, the great Ludwig Wittgenstein of the 20th century, in the end, he too thought that whereof we cannot speak, thereof we must remain silent, to use one of his quotations. Namely, maybe the most important things in life are things which cannot be said. In the case of Lao Tzu, it's often associated with a quietism, the idea that you should let things flow over you. But of course, that becomes rather contradictory at times, because should you let things flow over you, are you telling somebody that's what you ought to do? And then, of course, you are trying to take control of them. So I thought it was quite a useful philosopher to mention at the beginning, who does raise these problems about the freedom of the will. To what extent are you free to be doing these things which he recommends, when he basically tells you not to be recommending anything, and so forth. And he does then link in rather well with the ancient Greek philosopher Parmenides, who with Zeno was also raising the issues about what can you say about the world such that you are talking about things which do not exist. And that leads him to many paradoxes, some of which you may well be aware of. But you find those paradoxes in Lao Tzu. You even find them in Bertrand Russell and Wittgenstein. I'll give you a very quick example, but in the early 20th century, the very young, very arrogant, very clever Wittgenstein turned up at Cambridge at the door of Bertrand Russell. He had learnt about Bertrand Russell as being the great philosopher and mathematician, and he wanted to learn something about him. And they got into conversation. He asked, basically, Russell, am I mad or am I a genius? And after a few days, Russell ended up thinking he was a genius. They fell out in the end. But at one point, the young Wittgenstein is discussing with Russell, and Russell is saying, there is not an hippopotamus in this room. And Wittgenstein said, that's nonsense. It's not true. To which Russell said, well, obviously it's true. There's no hippopotamus in this room. And he pretended to look under the desks and so on, saying, look, Ludwig, or look, Vitus, there's no hippopotamus here. But Wittgenstein refused to accept that it is true to say there's no hippopotamus in the room. And that may seem bizarre, but as Russell would point out, indeed Wittgenstein is pointing out, it's a question about how can you speak about something which is not there? How can you make sense of speaking about non-existent things? And that's what you find is a great problem in Parmenides. You find that played around with by Lewis Carroll in the Alice books. The White King says to Alice, whom do you see coming along the road? Nobody, says Alice. Ah, to have such eyes, to be able to see nobody as well as that. And so it goes on in that frame of mind. There continues then to be a philosophical question about how can you speak about what does not exist? You could relate that to about how can you speak about children which do not yet exist, are not yet conceived? Why should we worry about them? How do you speak about the deceased? If you think people who die have involved complete annihilation, then why are you concerned about their non-existence? So it moves into great problems of ethics and morality as well, once you start thinking about non-existence. So I have moved seamlessly, so to speak, away from Lao Tzu, who is utterly bizarre, and I would hate to try to explain him in great detail, to some things which we can get a grip on. It goes back to try to explain in everyday language what the issues are here.
Right. And that makes it a great place for the book to begin. And things get very lively in the second chapter, in which you talk about this woman called Sappho. And your very first sentence of this chapter spells out something very intriguing about her inclusion here, when you tell us Sappho, in today's popular imagination, is famed as lesbian, but hardly as philosopher. And you go on to explain, in at least in some conventional senses of the word, Sappho was not what we think of as a philosopher, and yet obviously there were things about her and what she represented which you think where she in fact merits inclusion here. Tell us the ways in which she was not in some ways a philosopher and yet very much engaged in philosophy in a really important way.
Well, he certainly was not a philosopher in the sense of many philosophers, particularly in the last few centuries, will try to set out formal arguments for their position. There is no formal argument by Sappho. Furthermore, we only have fragments of her poetry in any case, so some scholars would even doubt the existence of an individual called Sappho. Many scholars would doubt whether Sappho was in fact a lesbian individual. Some spoke of her being married, some spoke of her having children, and so forth. So there's lots of mystery and enigma about Sappho, just as indeed there is about Lao Tzu. I hasten to say, as the book progresses, we get more and more concrete individuals, such as G.E. Moore by chapter 20, whatever it is. But these first two are rather iffy individuals. But Sappho certainly merits concern here because it makes the point, once again, that you can raise philosophical issues which are important without setting them out in a formal argument, and indeed without even having the complete poetry in front of you. And why there's a reason why I can justify this is the great Plato, who did set out arguments, who is sort of arguably the greatest philosopher around. People often write that to Plato's thinking. Plato thought of Sappho as explaining the pathway towards acquiring the ultimate truths of beauty and truth itself. So Plato did actually think that love between men, well, in this case, between boys and men, but between men and women and so forth, can actually lead you to appreciate the idea of beauty, which can lead you to the forms of truth and the ideal. Of course, you may get distracted on the way, being biological blobs, as I call us. So it's not a convincing argument, really. But yes, there is something about it, about love can give you the idea of something going beyond this world. And that, of course, is what Plato is trying to do. And that is, in a sense, what Sappho does with all the complexities, all the contradictions of how you are empowered because you love someone so much that you are frightened of it because you become... you lose your potency. You are at their mercy. You know all the dangers involved. You are nodding and smiling, Greg.
I'm enjoying this very much. You have already made brief mention of the philosopher whose work you explore in the third chapter, Zeno of Elea, you will pronounce it better than I, and have even briefly touched on the matter that he is probably best known for the paradoxes that he underlined and pointed out to the rest of us with which we continue to wrestle. What would be a couple of your favorite examples of such paradoxes? And also, in a sense, what do we gain by wrestling with such paradoxes?
You see, once again, Greg, you are falling into the trap in terms of what do we gain? That's the merchandise philosophy of, right, dare I say, Americans and of Tory Britain. But I'll put that to one side. Then we could discuss at some point about the dangers here of not taking into account the great suffering around us in the States and in other countries, of course. But yes, the great Zeno paradox is the one of Achilles and the tortoise, which I suspect many readers and listeners would already be aware of, though they sometimes confuse it with, I think, Achilles and the hare, in which Achilles goes to sleep, or the hare and the tortoise, one of them goes to sleep. But no, Achilles and the tortoise, for Zeno, is the one in which the tortoise is given a head start, or many head start, and they're having a race. Achilles is the fastest runner in Athens, the tortoise is, of course, a very slow creature. And the argument, though, is very simple. When they start running, before Achilles can overtake the tortoise, he's got to get to where the tortoise started. But by the time he does that, the tortoise will have moved a little further. And by the time Achilles gets to that new position, the tortoise will have moved a little further still. These increments are ever, ever decreasing. And mathematicians will smugly announce, oh, well, we know how a series of decreasing entities, such as those distances, can be summed. But nonetheless, there remains a philosophical problem about how can an endless series ever be ended? It's far more easily expressed if you just think that before you can reach the end before you can touch the wall opposite where you're sitting, you need to get halfway, then half of that halfway, then half of that halfway, and so forth. That's an endless series. And it's rather too smug, I think, to say, oh, well, these infinite series can be summed to a total, because there still is a philosophical problem about it's an endless series, so how can it be ended? I think that's a very deep problem, and some philosophers still do. Some mathematically inclined philosophers think, no, it's just a mathematical puzzle, which mathematicians have solved. I go for the humility stakes.
I like that.
That does relate, of course, to Parmenides talking about how can you talk about what doesn't exist. And once you are thinking about the past and the future, well, the past doesn't exist. That's over, it's past. The future doesn't exist. That isn't yet to be. And so you've only got the present. And what's the present if it's a line between two non-existents, the past non-existing and the future non-existing? Hence the puzzle again of time. And that brings us back to Taggart and G.E. Moore, of course.
Wow.
All things conspire, I think, in philosophy. Everything combines in various ways.
For sure. Speaking of the old, speaking of the past and the distant past, you tell us in your fourth chapter about one Socrates that one of the most intriguing things about him is that he wrote nothing. That is, he wrote nothing himself. And it is only through the voice of Plato that we can, in a sense, hear the voice of Socrates. What kind of challenge does that present in terms of understanding who Socrates was and what he represented, if we only have Plato as our guide?
We mainly have Plato. There were one or two other Greek writers who allude to Socrates and make a few comments about him. And Aristophanes, the playwright, mocked Socrates as having his head in the clouds. So there are some indirect references to Socrates. But yes, Plato is the most important figure in talking about Socrates. And in a sense, we should distinguish between the individuals and the philosophy which they're representing. Scholars will argue, and I assume they argue pretty easily and correctly, that some early writings of Plato pretty clearly are following the line of Socrates. There's evidence to suggest that. And so you have Plato's early dialogues, then his middle dialogues, then his later dialogues, and there's a gradual transition from some very early ones where you really think this is Plato describing Socrates' view, and then it slowly develops into Plato's view. And one non-dialogue written by Plato is indeed Socrates' so-called apology when he was being in court and was being tried for corrupting the youth and, actually worshipping many gods. It's called The Apology, but when you read it, and it's worth reading, it's a very short piece by Plato talking about what Socrates says. Socrates clearly is not really apologizing at all. He's saying that they should be feasting him, they should be thanking him, they should be praising him for actually being this sort of stickler, this one who's quite keen to stimulate people. He calls himself the gladfly, trying to get people into thinking about what's going on in society. So that's incredibly important. Socrates also is the one which people always say truthfully. So he said the unexamined life is not worth living. Well, I think at times maybe it's better not to examine it, but at other times it is better to examine it. And that could bring us all the way up to the 20th century, well, the 19th century, and Friedrich Nietzsche, for example, who very much is concerned about you having to decide what sort of life ought you to live. And as you probably know, Nietzsche is sort of another existentialist philosopher. He mocks the Englishman. He says the Englishman is only concerned about happiness. That's got nothing to do with how you ought to live. And so he's unfairly linked to this idea of the superman, but he does think that man could improve itself, by men and women could improve themselves and have more flourishing lives. I don't know if you come across what Nietzsche calls the greatest weight. The greatest weight is what he calls the eternal recurrence. And he describes it vividly about, imagine a demon steals into your bedroom at night and tells you that this life which you're living now, you'll have to live again and again eternally. So exactly the same life. Every note, every movement will be exactly the same. There'll be no feeling of deja vu. Your whole life will be repeated again and again without end. And he described this in a very, very vivid way. And then the demon says, then Nietzsche asks of the demon, how well disposed could anybody be, having heard this from the demon, to their lives? Or would you not fall to the ground and gnash your teeth and not bear to face the idea of your life going on eternally in exactly the same way? Well, if you think about that, that's a bit of metaphysics. Does it make sense to think of the world going on eternally in exactly the same way? Well, arguably, it's a piece of nonsense. If it really is exact repetition, it's no repetition at all. But nonetheless, it does actually manage to make one jump up and think, can I be so proud of my life, so pleased with how I conduct my life, that I would welcome the idea of it being eternally returning? The greatest weight, says Nietzsche, how can we handle it? So yes, once again, seamlessly, I've moved on from Socrates now to Nietzsche to show what a widespread of philosophers there are in this book.
It's true. Yeah, thank you for that. And I'm going to circle us back to the philosopher who follows Aristotle, the aforementioned Plato, to ask you about something that probably a lot of us already knew about Plato, namely that his favored way of presenting his philosophical thoughts was through dialogue. And you say a little earlier in this fifth chapter, for Socrates and for Plato, thinking is at its best when in dialogue with others. And of course, this is in some contradiction to what probably a lot of us carelessly imagine philosophers doing, that is, thinking great profound thoughts in some sequestered ivory tower and not necessarily in dialogue. And of course, the assumption is nonsense, but I want you to expand on that if you would. What is it about dialogue that helps us think at a higher level?
Yes, you're certainly right. And one paradox of Plato is that he did so many writings, of course, which are then fixed on the page, and readers then start doing their interpretations, but they can't engage with the thinker, with the writer. And so one reason why dialogue is important for Plato is you are face to face with individuals, and you can see their looks, their glances, their misunderstandings, and that can stimulate both parties in order to try to explain themselves, and one hopes to get nearer to the truth. The importance, therefore, is that if you are just reading a book, dare I say, even my book, you may feel everything is just set there in stone, and the author, of course, cannot engage with the reader because the author is no longer there, and the reader can make many mistakes or many very bright suggestions that the author will never benefit from them. And for decades, for thousands of years, I've taught, lectured at universities in Great Britain. And in fact, I've always learned things from engaging in dialogue with my students. I haven't just learned that they're getting terribly bored with what I've said or that a particular joke hasn't gone down well. I actually have been stimulated into thinking, oh, there's some subtle points there which I haven't understood. And I think Plato, although he may not come over as humble, actually was humble enough to think we should be engaged in this task to try to reach some conclusion which all of us can realize this is a way. This is a way of understanding how we ought to live. Of course, that's wildly optimistic, but there you are. I always tend to think things will get worse, but it's probably how things do go in that way. It's certainly better than sitting just alone in a room reading a book. It's better to maybe use the book as a stimulus, any book, and then go to the pub or go to the bar or go out into the glades, into the forest, and chat with other people to see where it's getting. I strongly recommend that. And for many decades in Great Britain, the great universities of Oxford and Cambridge and the old University of London would actually have that dialogue form, where sadly now most universities, and probably it's true in the States as well, are really lectures to maybe 100 students or 50 students or even 250 students. So you have lost that interface of a face-to-face discussion, which is very sad, but these things happen.
Agreed.
As I said, things get worse. And I dare say before they get better.
Right. I just want to make a mention of the fact that you touch on Socrates and Plato, and of course Aristotle, who follows Plato, and your chapter about him explains some of the interesting ways in which they were quite different from one another, in some respects even diametrically opposed to one another, yet had this relationship of respect. And we leave it to our listeners to explore that on their own. Because time is limited, I want to actually leap ahead and talk about someone else that we have already touched on briefly, but he merits at least a minute or two of our time, namely Jean-Paul Sartre. And unlike some of the figures in your book who maybe would not have called themselves philosophers, or we do not necessarily think of as philosophers, Sartre is, of course, a philosopher, one of the most famous. And early in this chapter, you say something intriguing about him, namely, he was probably the most famous philosopher of any philosopher within their lifetime, which suggests that some philosophers only gain renown after they're gone. I mean, only in retrospect, upon further reflection, do we realize the value of the work of a given philosopher. But not Sartre. He it sounds like he made a very strong impact while he was here, while he was alive.
Yes, Sartre certainly did, and another philosopher who did, but not such an impact in that sense, was the British Bertrand Russell. Both of those made impacts in the wider world because they're very much involved in political action. And so that's true that, you know, society had their attention drawn to them. But Sartre's philosophy was also important, not just because of the political action. It's because he was perceived very much as the existentialist philosopher, trying to point out to us how we have to be held responsible for how we conduct our lives. So it's coming back to this theme, which I've alluded to in Nietzsche and in Kierkegaard, namely, we have to decide how to live. And this is where Sartre's famous book, Being and Nothingness, is a stress on the nothingness. It sounds bizarre, it goes back to the non-existence feature again, but Sartre is making the point that whatever's going on in your life and so forth, you're still having to choose what to do. And you ought not to evade responsibility by saying, well, I had to do that because I was a waiter or because I was in an army. You are making those choices. So that's quite a powerful idea, going back to Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, about being responsible for your actions. Linking in also with something you said about Sartre, yes, some philosophers are hardly known at their time, so a fine example of that is Leibniz. Leibniz is now thought of as an incredibly great philosopher and mathematician, but when he died, I think there were just two or three people at his graveside, so he died a man who felt himself as having failed because he wanted to be far wider known. At that point he was wider known, but in the end he was just stuck in Hanover, which was then a backwater in Germany. Another philosopher, though, who was more famous, but for bad reasons at the time, is Spinoza in the 17th century. Poor Spinoza was excommunicated by the Amsterdam synagogue, and so he was cursed. You can read the curses. They say, cursed be he when he goes to bed, cursed be he when he gets up in the morning, cursed be he when he has a drink, and so on. He gets all these curses, and no Jew should go near him. He was Jewish, of course. And actually, at the time, he had a merchandise business that wasn't at all good for business. But Spinoza, especially these days, is thought of as being a great philosopher. He often is called the God-intoxicated atheist. Namely, some philosophers see him as an atheist because God is just nature or an extension of nature, whereas others see him as a great God-intoxicated philosopher. So those are very interesting individuals. But going back to Sartre, Sartre is a fascinating individual because of this commitment to the idea you have to choose how you live. And he writes very well on self-deception and how all the time some of us, well, I think all of us, most of the time, do deceive ourselves into thinking we had to behave in that way, we had to behave in this way, whereas we have made those choices. Even if I stress, even if it's true, it's a deterministic world, which might well be true, and that goes back to Lao Tzu again. Even if you do think there's a neurological explanation for everything that you do, Greg, nonetheless, that still doesn't tell you whether when you go out tonight you should wear the red dress or the blue dress. You still have to choose. So whatever you think about determinism, scientific determinism, that doesn't allow you to be evade, to escape having to make choices, which I think is a very important point, which I derive from Sartre. And indeed Lao Tzu, far more indirectly.
Yeah. I want to make sure we take a few moments to talk about the very intriguing person who follows in your book, namely Simone de Beauvoir, who was Sartre's very close friend and indeed lover for many, many years. And her approach to philosophical concepts is a really intriguing one, which you sum up in a term, situatedness, where she wants this kind of deep thinking, deep pondering to not be in the abstract in a sense, but rather in concrete terms, having to do with real people in real social situations. Tell us more about this approach and how it is in some respects a very refreshing approach to a lot of what we've been talking about today.
Yeah, certainly that concept of situatedness is very much one from Simone de Beauvoir, but it's one which she emphasizes, but you can similarly find it in Sartre. You can even find it in Kierkegaard. Namely, all of them are concerned about the subjectivity, your position in the world as a subject. And Simone de Beauvoir, though, is stressing that you are a subject within a certain culture, within a certain way of thinking. And so she is famously associated, of course, with the way in which, prior to Simone de Beauvoir pressing home on this point, some people would think that they were born a woman with all of those requirements, expectations of what a woman should do and be. Whereas Simone de Beauvoir will again be stressing that's been imposed on you by your situatedness. And as with Sartre, you would have the right, or not the right, you ought to recognize that you should acknowledge that you are free about this, that you can stand up against this, or you can fall in line with it. But you ought not to say, oh, well, I must have children because I'm a woman and that's expected of me, or oh, I must be a devoted wife because that's what's expected of me, or as a woman, I must sort of acknowledge that a man is stronger, and so forth. What's the idea of strength? Is that strength in terms of physical strength or emotional strength, and so on? So she brings out those points, famously to do with the position of women, but it did then extend into the position of what she calls the other, namely black people within a white community, or for that matter, white people within a black community, and so forth. So it's a very, very important philosophy in that sense. I'm not sure if you're right to say that she was for a long time a lover of Jean-Paul Sartre. They were certainly together throughout all their lives, but I think the sexual love element of it got changed somewhat as they went off in many of their other respective ways. Mm. And there are some rather unpleasant stories about how they would sort of pop a woman from one side to the other side, you know, and discuss what was going on sexually with them. I don't know how true those stories are, but there does seem to be evidence for it. But no, they're fascinating intellectuals, and in France, you can be looked up to as an intellectual. In Britain, certainly, intellectual is normally thought of as a bad sign. Hmm. The only person who got away with it was Bertrand Russell, but that was because he was prepared to sit down in Trafalgar Square in London and object to nuclear weapons. Hmm. In fact, Bertrand Russell, he was a great aristocrat in the end, Lord Russell, but he ended up going to prison in 1916 because he was supporting conscientious objection and so forth. And he ended up being sent to prison again in the 1950s or 60s because of his anti-nuclear war demonstrations. So he's another great figure, very politically active. Another politically active figure is Simone Weil. In my book, I mentioned how Simone Weil and Simone de Beauvoir, both French philosophers, were discussing, and Simone de Beauvoir said, oh, this Simone Weil, she goes on and on about feeding the world. Don't you realize, Simone Weil, the real important point is to find the meaning to your life? To which Simone Weil replied, I can tell you've never gone hungry. I think that's a very important point, that we should bring ourselves down when we talk in abstract things about how we should live, find meaning to our lives. Let's remember there are millions, if not billions, of people around truly suffering and going hungry or being bombed and so forth. And it's rather smug of us as philosophers, I include myself, to get on our high horse talking about these things when there's so much suffering around us. Hmm. Paradoxically, or more accurately, interestingly, that is what led Nietzsche to talk in terms of how you must be strong if you are going to face the fact that you're going to live your life and flourish, because you should be aware that your life rests on the suffering of millions of others. Hmm. It's an old ancient Greek proverb, all things conspire, and Nietzsche would stress that whatever we're doing today, it all rests on the sufferings of others in the past or going on right now. Hmm. I think of the food you're getting, think of the clothes you're having, think of the imports you're having, think of your mobile phone, which has got all these special cobalt inside it to make the batteries, which are brought about by children scrappling around in Africa, digging for it. So, yes, I can end on a gloomy note. That's why I enjoy Samuel Beckett. He brings that out as well. Hmm. About how we are trapped in this world of biological unhappiness. Hmm. Hence, some of us escape into music, as I think you do, Ray.
I do. And I escape into great, interesting, entertaining, illuminating books like the one that you've written. And although, indeed, we did end on a somewhat somber note, in fact, there's very little that's somber about this exploration of the work of these 30 great philosophers. It is a book that is truly stimulating and enjoyable on so many different levels. Again, it is titled, How to Think Like a Philosopher, Scholars, Dreamers, and Sages Who Can Teach Us How to Live. It's published by Bloomsbury Continuum and its author, Peter Cave. Peter Cave, I was privileged to speak with you today about this wonderful book. I learned so much from the book and from this conversation, and I thank you so much.
And thank you for inviting me, Greg. I enjoyed the conversation as well. If only it was face-to-face over a glass of wine, but there you are. Thank you.